Okay, meeting's called to order before proceeding with any business. Mr. Cook has a statement tonight.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A public notice of this meeting containing all items on this proposed agenda has been filed in the Office of Secretary of State. As required by Chapter 551 Government Code, the first year is the Open Meetings Act. I would like for this fact to be noted in the official records of this meeting.
Thank you, Mr. Cook. Begin today with the Finance Committee.
Thank you, Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First order of business is approval of the previous committee meeting minutes. Administrative, is there a motion?
Second.
And all those. Discussion? Hearing none, call question. All those say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carries. Item number one, land and water plans update.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This Friday, we will, along with several other state agencies, go down and testify to the House Appropriations Subcommittee on General Government. This subcommittee is chaired by Representative Warren Chisholm, who has been asked to provide a brief presentation on our operating budget and plans to carry out legislative initiatives along with other matters affecting the physical condition of the department and the state. And we're going to do that by minute. It'll be brief and short, and I think pretty much just saying, here's what we did this year, getting the year started, here's where we are, and that's about how long it will take, unfortunately at times, but that's what we're preparing for. Administrative resources and information technology staff continue to work with staff in the field on fine-tuning our new boat registration and titling system that was implemented in early January. That process is going very well. And as with all new systems, there are issues that have to be worked out, and staff are committed to make the system and processes run as smoothly as possible. I think from what I'm hearing from people across the state, our folks have done a great job working well with these people, and it is functioning well. Each of you has, I believe, at your seat one of these booklets prepared by Mr. Friedkin and some of his folks. And I want to tell you about the project that they've got going just very briefly, and then I'll let Mr. Friedkin and Mr. Ramos speak to it if they wish. Under the leadership of Commissioner Friedkin and Ramos, a group of potential partners and sponsors have been working on plans to hold a professional bass tournament on Lake Fork in April of 2007. The goal of the group, led by Gulf States Toyota, is to create and execute an event which will raise significant funds to benefit the agency's fisheries and youth programs. The Texas Bass Classic will be governed by the rules and regulations of TPWD and will set new standards within the competitive fishing industry.
I think that states it well, and I just want to thank Bill and his staff and everyone at TPW who's been involved in it. I think it's going to be a great event, and we're looking forward to it.
We are very enthused about it, and it's shaping up to be a great event.
And of course, I can't say enough to thank Dan and his support staff. I've always felt that just like our Quantale industry, the bass industry is a tremendous asset to this day. And what I think is unique about the bass industry is that it offers an opportunity to more of the youth of the state to fish. It's not as expensive to buy a little fishing rod and a lure as it is to go buy a 7mm Magnum rifle and access a hunting lease. So we thought it was time to showcase not only Lake Fork, but all the other Great Lakes in the state. And this is kind of what drove this project. And we think it will accomplish at least three things. One, it's going to hopefully bring some money to our fisheries to improve the quantity of our fish. Two, it will serve as an educational experience for the youth of the state to learn about fishing and how great it is to go spend an afternoon catching 6 or 8 10-pound bass, whatever. Lake Fork has a lot of those. And then lastly, and I have to give Bill credit for this, and that is setting a new standard at these fishing tournaments to where you can actually have a tournament within the standards as they exist there. And it's kind of a new phase, and Bill has to get full credit. But anyway, we're excited. We think it's a fantastic, great.
Likewise.
a good deal. My understanding is that initially the plan is to, as the years go by, to move around the state to different locations. Is that?
That's correct. The whole state over a period of time.
Very good. All right. Thanks, sir.
$1 million pumps.
The match industry is just great in this state and throughout the country. And we thought it was time to start waving our flag. We're here. We have some great bass fishing in Texas.
Mr.
Chairman,
I'll compliment
DeNato and remind everybody that this happened because the father took his son fishing on Lake Fork about 18 months plus ago. And he came away from there with a spark in his head. But it was a father taking a child fishing, and they had an experience. And that, this is what it's done.
That actually confirmed everything that I had heard about Lake Fork. And the thing is that, you know, there's a lot of other lakes like Lake Fork throughout the state. And that's a reflection of our staff and our dedication to the fisheries. And the bass industry is huge. I mean, we have to recognize that the bass industry is a huge industry in this state.
That's a wonderful program. Thanks to both of you. Item number two, state parks funding issues.
Mr. Chairman, in way of introduction here, I want to give credit to Dabney. He has been presenting this program across the state. I wouldn't even have to guess how many times, but he's done a great job in many different locations, many different audiences and types of folks who are interested in our parks. And I thought it was important that you hear exactly what those folks across the state have been hearing from Walt and have the opportunity to as you would wish. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman and Commissioners, I'm Walt Dabney. I'm going to stand up in a second to give the presentation because I feel better on my feet than sitting down here. But it cuts off my circulation.
Yeah.
Anyway, Bob said we're giving this all over the state. Put this program together in response to folks inviting me and us to come and talk to them about what had happened to their parks. We, as you know, after years of having difficulties, ran into a situation where we really affected the operations in nearly half of the state parks in the system this year. We're cut back in operations in about 50 of them and had to eliminate a number of positions. People literally called us and wanted to know, why are you doing this to my park? And one of the things that you know, I'm sure, and it was loud and clear to me, that when I show up in Palestine or I show up in Cooper or I show up in Giddings, those parks, whether it's Nails Creek over at Somerville or whether it's Doctors Creek at Cooper Lake or the railroad, that is their local park. It may be a unit of the state park system, and when it goes down, both because they like to use it and because it means something to them economically, they are upset about this. And I think we're seeing that all over the state. As Bob said, I've given this probably in 24 or more places, from River Oaks Country Club to a town meeting in El Paso, and I've probably got another dozen more scheduled. I don't think any more with a tuxedo, Commissioner, but I've got it just in case. Anyway, I'm going to start that presentation and be glad to answer any questions afterward.
This is working okay? Can you hear me well? This idea of parks is really an American idea. The notion probably coming from our ancestors who came at least initially from Europe, where you didn't have the opportunity have big special places that weren't reserved for royalty or the very wealthy, was manifested initially in this country in 1872 when this nation set aside Yellowstone National Park. One of the interesting things about that in the early days is folks said, I don't know why you're doing that. It's all the way out west. No one will ever get there. You probably hear that with Big Bend Ranch now. Someday people are going to be saying, thank God somebody was thinking not 5 years down the road, but 50 years down the road. and they set these places aside. This idea of parks in the United States has grown to where not only are special places like the Grand Canyon and Yellowstone enshrined forever and protected forever, and indeed they not only are American treasures, there's only one Grand Canyon in the world or Yellowstone, so they're truly international treasures. The National Park System is a repository of some of our special historic sites, whether that be Independence Hall or Manassas or Gettysburg or whatever. This idea has grown to where every one of the 50 states now has a state park system, and indeed the world has grown to where this idea has been copied in probably 150 countries around the world, both to protect what they have that's unique and special, and also because they understand this is an important economic factor. The mission of state parks, everyone would understand, has a definite recreation destination, a place to go have a good, safe time with your family. It is also more than that. It's a repository where we keep some of our special historic resources or cultural resources, and certainly examples of the diversity of the Texas landscape. And thirdly, a place where we teach people about that, whether it's school groups, and we deal with thousands of them every year, or whether it's the visiting public in general. There are 114 state park units, including 34 historic sites. Our visitation is now about 10.5 million visits a year to the system. Within this, we have some of the great examples of Texas history, whether that be the Indian culture, the Native American prehistory, or whether that be the establishment of government presence. An example of that certainly are the frontier forts, where most of these weren't actually Indian battle sites or anything. They were a place to establish the presence and law and order on a frontier that was pretty wild at that time. It also includes some very unique and challenging experiences or units, like the Texas State Railroad, which was a vital piece of East Texas history, and it is one that has got a lot of interest right now because we've got to make some deliberate decisions about the Texas State Railroad. It's a very expensive operation to run, but it is a neat experience if you've never been there. Nothing is easy as a railroad. You don't go to the auto parts store to get new parts for this thing. We have to make everything that we use there. Another challenge that this state has got to deal with is the battleship Texas. We've got some ideas to do this better than we've done it in the past, which is hauling it to dry dock and picnic for a while and then hauling it back and doing it again. Makes no sense in the long term. We need to address the battleship Texas. It's a very popular destination. It truly is a nationally significant artifact, not so much Texas significant. But this is the last of these dreadnought battleships in the world and fought in World War I and World War II, actually supported our landing at Normandy. So there's a lot of interest in what we're going to do with this. A place like Sauer Beckman Farm is one of our historic sites. It's a place where you can bring school kids out there to experience what it was like 70 or 80 years ago, and it absolutely blows them away that 80 years ago folks were not, in fact, going to HEB to get what they needed. They had to grow it, and they had to put it up, they had to kill it and render it and get it ready for the winter, or they didn't eat in the winter. There was no ATP to go to. It's really an incredible experience for them. San Jacinto, one of the sites in that are dear to Texas, and as all of you learned growing up, it's the place where we won our independence from Mexico. It is a bigger story than that. It is truly a nationally significant site. It is a place where in 18 minutes, in April of 1836, in an 18-minute fight, all or parts of seven or what are now the United States were won. It's as big as the Louisiana Purchase or the Alaska Purchase and that kind of thing. So it is truly a major story. It is also not a story about whites and Hispanics fighting, because the Texicans included all ethnic backgrounds, and they were fighting a Mexican dictator who was not going to support freedom for them. So collectively, they were fighting Santa Ana, and it's a wonderful story to tell. The Casa Navarro House in San Antonio, Jose Navarro, was a signer of the Declaration of Independence and a true Texas hero. Also, we have many sites in the system that represent the diversity of the Texas landscape. If you don't own your own place, this is what most Texans have to go enjoy. And within this system, we got great examples from east to west and north to south of what Texas was like, and these places will stay this way forever. It's a great place where if you don't have your own place to go, you make those family memories that will never go away. And they're terribly important to growing up, and I guarantee you, if you look at this, if these kids look at this picture someday, and they are telling the story about how we went fishing at this park with my dad, and the redfish we caught was at least as big as my little brother. He's got the picture to prove it. It's also a place where you can go to do almost any kind of activity you want to do. Great adventures in Texas State Park. One of the places where we had to cut back operations was at Nails Creek at Lake Somerville, a major equestrian destination. You think of Texas as being this great equestrian state where we got all these cowboys. If you don't own a ranch, there are very few places if you own a horse to go ride. The park system is one of them, and these folks are a constituent group that are really coming to the bat saying we need more of these places. We don't need to be shutting what we have. Education. If we're not teaching these kids about their history, we're not teaching these kids about the important places and events that made Texas what it is and made us who we are, you may as well live anywhere because there's nothing that grabs you right here that grounds you back into who we are as Texans, or in fact in the national system, who we are as Americans. If you don't understand natural science, if you don't understand interrelationships with plants and animals and water and air, we will continue as these young people grow up to be parents and voters and legislators and decision makers to make stupid decisions that maybe someday are irreversible and taken care of living in an environment that we are constantly affecting. Well, we've got a great system, but this system is indeed in some serious problems. Just a little background on the budget issues that got us here. If you look just at the last 5 years, I've been here 7 years now wrestling with this, with certainly the support of this commission and our leadership here. Just in the last 5 years, if you look at our budget, it's basically been flat, actually down a little bit in 2006. The big problem is, with $1.5 million or $2 million we're down in 2006, our expenses have gone up significantly in the last 6 years, 5 years. Obviously, fuel costs, utility costs, all those kinds of things have escalated significantly. We brought on the World Birding Center and Government Canyon and some other places that we didn't have the full operating costs available to get those started. In fact, Government Canyon is a great example. You can see downtown San Antonio from a hill on a mountain bike trail in Government Canyon, and we're open 4 days a week. I mean, this is a park that ought to be open fully. It ought to be available to the millions of people that are in San Antonio, and we were only able to open the door 4 days a week. Personnel costs have increased. So we're down at the beginning of this year somewhere close to $8 million just in where we were in 2002, and we were already in trouble in 2002. What that caused in December, we eliminated 73 more positions because the year before that we'd already dumped some positions. We cut back operations in about 50 parks, and that includes taking some of the historic sites down to 2 or 3 days a week being open. Some parks we converted from overnight use to day use only. We cut back hours of operation and closed some facilities at least seasonally. The legislature gave us the authority with Rider 27 that if we generate additional revenues, we can apply to use those revenues. That's the only thing that kept the wheels from completely flying off the system. I had another 87 positions that would have probably been 90 or more by the time we pulled the trigger on this that were going to have to go that we couldn't pay. That would have shut down a whole bunch more parks. And when you shut down more operations, then you don't collect revenue. And when you don't collect revenue, that makes your problem worse. We would have been in a complete downward spiral, I think, without Rider 27. We'd have had a crash of the whole system. So we're holding our own. This $4.88 million that the comptroller certified available to us to operate didn't restore anything. Those 50 sites are still in reduced operation. We didn't bring back any of these 73 positions, but we didn't go to the next round of cuts. So Rider 27 actually brought us up some and kept us from having to go more drastically in the hole. Texas Recreation account, the one that you give grant approvals all over the state, extremely popular. It provides these kind of outdoor recreation grants, indoor recreation facilities, and so forth. That program in 2002 had, with appropriations and interest, about $20+ million available to make grants. We still weren't able to award all the grants that we had applications for. Now we're down to just to $5.5 million with interest, and we're able to fund less than 1 in 4 of the people that are actually applying. And there's fewer applying because they know we don't have any money now. And this is to build new city and county parks in at least a dollar for dollar match. Most of the places that build a park put a whole lot more than a matching dollar into this program. We're doing everything we can to make this work better. We're using lots of different volunteers. Now, you might question whether the TDCJ crew is a volunteer group or not, but they have, you know, life is better outside is our motto. And after each day's work, we give them a bumper sticker to take back with them. I don't mean to make light of this. These guys do us a lot of work. 85,000 man hours a year. I wish it were 4 times that much. They love coming out. It's great for the taxpayer. It's great for them. They'd rather be doing that than sitting in a cell. And a lot of them have said, man, I get out, I want to come back and show my family what we helped build out here. Community service workers, people that screw up and the judge says you're going to have to go do something somewhere useful, and a lot of them come to us. The real big story, however, is the true volunteer. Over 400,000 documented hours every year. If we didn't have available to us these programs, we literally could not operate the system. These people do things like building trails, but they collect money, they give programs, they mow grass, they clean bathrooms for free.
That's worth pausing now. Notice that total FTE, full-time employed equivalent. 300, basically talking 300 employees to work on, and we don't have to pay.
How did you figure my Boy Scouts in there? Were they like five Boy Scout people, one person?
At the most. At the most. Now, if we can get a Girl Scout crew in there, that'll
do some work. My Boy Scout troop was -1
FTE. We actually do get a lot of Eagle Scout projects coming into parks that people are looking for. This number is equivalent to about 25% of our paid classified staff. I mean, they are incredible, and they are wonderful. They have to work at least 25 hours a week. Most of the time, they're working 40 to 50 or 60 hours a week. They just absolutely want to help. We're done as many innovative things as we can at the Texas State Railroad. We implemented 2 years ago a Kids Ride Free program. If we had vacancy, it pays to have two paying parents bring 2 or 3 kids in the train. As long as it's full and we got as many paying customers, it's increased our ridership and our revenue significantly in those 2 years. The free fishing celebration, we call it Fishing Free in State Parks, is a great deal. It isn't losing the city fishing license. And just think about it. If you got somebody coming from Michigan, retired folks, and they're going to make a decision because of a $60 license to come stay with us 2 or 3 months because they can fish free, that for Texas is a great economic deal. Also encourages people that want to try fishing but don't want to buy a license to maybe get into it and go fish elsewhere. State Park Annual Pass, all of you I know have one. And I do as well. It's a great deal. We have sold just under 5,000 more of these this year than we did last year. People are loving this. It's really a passport to Texas State Parks, and it is going extremely well right now. It's a great gift. People are giving these as presents to folks. For $60 for a year, you can go in every single unit of the state park system as many times as you want with whoever is in your vehicle. A lot of people talk about parks are not a good business deal. That actually is not true. I don't know of many government agencies that make any of their budget back. We certainly do. But most parks do not, in fact, turn a profit if you look at just the budget and just the revenue coming in. Texas Coalition for Conservation contracted with Texas A&M University to look at 80 parks, and they measured these 4 things. Expenditures, impact on sales, personal income, and jobs measures. And what they found out, if you interview people that are coming in there and you eliminate those that already live there and you eliminate those that came because they were coming to visit Uncle Ned or whatever, and you just measure those people that came there because the attraction, because of the park, it's a significant number. Looking at Bastrop, for example, and in 04, Bastrop actually, I think, basically breaks even now. But in 04, it's a good example to use. We lost $77,000. But we didn't. If you look at the impact to Texas of Bastrop State Park and bringing people to Bastrop County that would not have come otherwise, $2.5 million in impact on sales, over $1 million in impact on personal income, and all a part of 84 jobs created at that area. That's a pretty good return on your money. In the state of Texas as a whole, A&M says that the impact on sales is just under $800 million, mostly in rural Texas. The impact on personal income, $456, and just under 12,000 jobs created by the park system being there. So we collect $37 or $38 million a year. Our budget, $56 million. We're looking at $28 million in tax money if you looked at it that is keeping this system afloat and generating that kind of economic benefit to Texas. Why do people come? According to Texas travel industry, they want these kinds of things, almost all of which are found in the state park system. According to A&M, we are the primary destination for tourism in the state, where tourism is the second biggest component of the economy in Texas. And we are second in the United States behind California as a tourist destination. We got some great attractions. Obviously, Palo Duro, the New World Burning Center down in the valley, is really going to be an international destination. You're going to have a little briefing by Director Russell Fishback tomorrow on where we are with the World Burning Center. But truly, people are coming from all over the globe to Texas because we are such a great burning destination, especially down in the Rio Grande Valley. One of the problems, if you have an attraction and it is not good, and I talked to some folks the other day, we're not ready to market Texas the way Arkansas and some of them are doing right now. We're not there. The way we've kept going is we haven't bought the last 2 years. We haven't replaced equipment. All these mowers are shot. We use them to part them out to keep a couple others going. And you're talking about a $500 mower here. Huge waste of personnel time to keep this keep this going. I've got the biggest collection of pack rats in the world. They won't get rid of anything because they know they're going to need it someday to keep something else going. We talked about the railroad. The only thing new in this picture are the railroad spikes. And the numbers to get the railroad going include the fact that we've got to replace most of the cross ties, at least in about 18 or 19 miles of the track. You're talking about another, with synthetic cross ties or concrete cross ties, is just under $600,000 a year to replace 700 of those a year. You're talking major. Battleship. We got to quit patching the hull of the battleship, get it up out of the water in a permanent solution, and start putting our money on the inside of this, stabilizing it and restoring the room so that it is truly a wonderful experience. It's a great, great experience now, but we got too many of those rooms that are locked up to the public. Lots of behind-the-scenes stuff. Obviously, the Transcendental Monument is now closed to visitation and hopefully will be open in the next couple of months. Behind the scenes, not only at San Jacinto, but in a lot of these places where you don't see, these are old. 31 of the parks were built by the CCC. 34 of them are historic sites, but even many of the other parks are 40, 50, 60 years old. I was telling somebody that the restroom, four of the restrooms I was cleaning in Ames Lake in 1966, they're still cleaning or trying to clean today. They are worn out. Speaking of which, winter destinations. This is Mustang Island. If you're a winter Texan coming down from Michigan and we've got this big ad campaign, come to Texas State Park, and you show up to Mustang Island to use the restroom, or if you ended up at Goose Island instead, this is what would welcome you. And that is not a good reflection on Texas, and it would go blow up on us if they went back to try to market this to their folks about coming down here. Inside a lot of these places, again, a lot of our facilities are great, but a whole lot of them are in trouble. Difficult to maintain these kinds of things. Our equipment, as I said, is tough. I was talking to somebody the other day who said, you know how old that tractor is? I said, no. He said, I'm 39 and it's 4 years older than I am. And this is typical of what we have. Our vehicle fleet is 10 years old on the average. We're putting more money into some of these vehicles than they are worth just to keep them running.
You missed the duck test,
I forgot. Commissioner Holmes or Commissioner Fitzsimmons could be given this program as well. They heard what the chairman is talking about. If you were very observant before I went past that, that hood, I just have a pointer. That is duct tape across the front of that thing, holding the hood on this 43-year-old tractor. Vehicles, our guys won't throw anything away. I mean, that truly is their parts store, and we rag on them all the time, get them off the inventory. They look like you got a real vehicle out there. Look at the door in the back. They will put that door on some other car. They just won't get rid of them. Nature beats us up on a regular basis. Hurricanes, especially Rita, knocked us out in 5 parks. We're nearly back online, and most of them to some extent. Our infrastructure is aging. Much of the bond money that we've spent so far has gone in the water and wastewater. You don't see the improvements above ground because we had such a backlog of those kinds of things, and obviously we needed to be fixing them. Callahan at Choke Canyon is a perfect example. That park is closed now because our water system failed. And we're doing major repairs now to try to get it back online and at least a temporary or emergency fix. So we're not doing very well taking care of what we have, 114 units of the park system. Several studies in the past, A&M, Governor Bush, put a group together, including Chairman Fitzsimmons, to look at taking care of Texas. Texas Tech did a follow-up study. All of these said Texas does not have enough land for this population today, and they got to get moving to meet the needs of a population that may well double in the next 15 years for the future. The legislature in our sunset told us to review these studies and to look at this ourselves. We put together what we call our strategic plan, the Land and Water Resources Plan. It calls for adding lands to existing parks. It calls for the establishment of 4 new state parks near the major metropolitan areas. We haven't done any of it, and there is no money to do any of these. There is no money to add any facilities to existing parks. So with that, the last thing somebody asked me the other day, is this TAPS or Reveille? And I like to think it is Reveille. With all the help that we're getting now, the chairman has appointed a state park advisory board, and they're looking at this very clearly, but I will just tell you, as a 40-year in this business, this system's in trouble. This system is in trouble. We are caretaking this system right now. I don't have the staff to invite new people in. We don't have the facilities or the equipment to take care of them. We literally are in a caretaker mode, and this has got to turn around pretty soon. We're 49th per capita spent on parks, and it really shows that now. So with that, I'd be glad to answer any questions you might have.
Well, as you know, I've been with you doing this a couple of times. One memorable one in Houston, and I thought it was really interesting there, your presentation and John Compton on that $28 million number. Think about that $28 million number. Really, all the net dollars we're putting in. And we're collecting $104 million in sporting goods sales tax. I think everybody around the table knows what the hook and blow community would do if less than 30% of their money got to where it was needed. And that's worth focusing on. The other thing is, this is a great presentation. There's one thing I don't want. I said this to the advisory group last week. Don't get too focused on fixing the bathroom. You know, how much, because pretty soon you're going to hear how much for the tithe, how much to fix the bathroom. If you do that, you're going to lose focus on the big vision and the plan for us to be able to really fund the vision that's in that plan. New parks, taking care of parks. Otherwise, you're just back to, you're just back to zero. And going back to zero is not going to get us to the goal we set out in our land water conservation plan. So that's just in my perspective. Oh, one of our State Park Advisory Board members just walked in. Dan Schoen, is anyone here?
Yes.
Well, we're going to have a presentation, I know,
next
on that, but they're doing great work, and John Monford John Monford in typical John Monford style is bringing a laser to this issue. Let's see, one other thing I didn't want to mention. On Government Canyon State Natural Area, not only is it only open 4 days, well, it was open the other day, riding a bike, but 8 years it took us to open 4 days a week. Let me put it this way. At that rate, that's not a 10-year plan that we have.
It's a great presentation, Walt. Thank you. You really highlighted the issues that we're confronting. And it's going to require the work of really everybody in this room and quite a lot more to help rectify this. And we need great help out of Chairman Hildebrand and two Todd back there, and we appreciate all that.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
I have one question. Well, towards the end of your presentation, you mentioned that we rank 49th in the country in, I think you said, in allocation of cost per capita for parks.
Yes, sir.
Can you elaborate a little bit on that? I guess what they've done is they've said the legislature or Parks and Wildlife, whatever, has spent X number of dollars.
They're looking at our total budget and the population and looking at a per capita figure there.
So they're looking at 28th in that number?
They're looking at the total number. Of that.
In that number, we're even low.
Oh, we're 54.
Somebody said the other day, thank God for Kansas.
Yeah, Kansas is the only one below us. And if you look at Louisiana, I talked to the director there, is over twice as much as we are. Louisiana is. New Mexico is 3 or 4 times more than we are. Oklahoma is 2 or 3 or 4 times more. Every state around us, and I guarantee you, they are intercepting people coming to Texas. They do.
Can we take that data, for example, say that in Texas, $30 are being allocated per citizen for parks as compared to other states that have 80 or 90? Do we have that data? I'd be interested in that.
We do that, have that data, and A&M is reworking it right now because depending on how a state reports it, they may report state parks in there, they may throw their museums in it and some other things. We're going to try to, John Crompton is going to try to refine this, so he's just talking parks. But I've got some of that initial data right now. I think the national average is $8 or $9, and we're $2.30 or something like that.
We're way below that.
As I recall, almost anywhere you look at those kinds of information on state park funding, there's 4 or 5 different ways that they present it through the National Park State Park Association. We're the 45th, 46th, 48th, 49th in everything.
With one exception. And that is how much of our budget we actually recover in revenue. We're in the top probably 10%. We are,
which speaks highly.
Florida has 170 state parks. You were down there, Chairman, when they were talking about this. They have the same revenue with 170 state parks that we have with 108. You were there too. I mean, we have milked this revenue about as much as we can without really turning people away.
And also got to be public support.
Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Three
other states are use some formula of sporting goods tax. Most of them have some combination of revenue, dedicated real estate tax, a bunch of different things. I had a presentation to the advisory board the other day that has that information. I could give you a copy of that presentation, and it'll give you some ideas of what other states are doing.
Arkansas did a percentage.
1/8 of 1 cent sales tax.
Sales. Colorado is a dedication of a lot of them. Florida is mainly real estate transfer.
5 of them are still using cigarette tax.
Yep.
Missouri and Oklahoma do the same thing. In fact, the sequence, but I believe on the 1/8 of 1 cent sales tax, Ohio, Pennsylvania, then Missouri, then Arkansas, then Oklahoma.
the sequence in terms of passage of that.
Yes, historic.
We have a very identifiable stream of revenue from the sources of sales tax, which in its totality is adequate to handle its needs. And there's a great nexus between the people that provide the sales tax revenue and on sporting goods and the people that use our park system. And I think, and I know that you've had, we've all worked on it and had recent conversations that would help tie that closer together to the actual appropriation.
That point is really important because a lot of people will back away from that and say, now, where's the thought about it?
Well, that's that local forest grant program. That's the local forest grant program. So don't back away from the fact that as Ned said, that there's a logical nexus between spending the money, paying your sales tax, and expecting that to go to a place you need it, and then you expect your gasoline tax to fit.
And in line with that, there's a direct nexus between deferring maintenance and then having to have a capital expenditure. And that's my concern that, you know, you can defer maintenance for some period of time. At that point, the deferral becomes a capital expenditure. And so the longer we wait, the more costly it's going to be for us and the state to get the parts.
The other piece of that, sir, is if you bond it and then have nothing in bond it, you can't do a logical planned approach to fixing this.
Yeah, Mr. Parker.
And the critical thing that we need to remember, the great job that our parks people are doing, is since the 77th legislature, 77th legislature cut our parks budget revenues by 5%, 78, 13%, 79, 5%, and then you have inflation on top of that. We are at a, they've got us by the shoulder.
There's an interesting point to that though, John, is that those cuts are disproportionately larger in the local parks grant, where you go from 20 to 5 million, which means in simplest terms, if you were coming in from a local community for a match of 200, you're now 50, which is the difference between building the park and not. Now, one of the comments you showed all those studies and having been involved in two of those, and some of them hopefully not just doorstops, you will hear over the next year and a half, geez, why all of a sudden is this a big issue? When I signed that letter on the taking care of Texas study in October of 2000, that was in the first paragraph of the executive summary. It says, if we don't do something on first funding, 50 barn centers, like right now, we're going to be in serious trouble. And so that's been on the record for some time.
It's not a new message.
But now the
chickens. Somebody do the math wrong and wake up one day and go, oh my God.
But now the chickens have come home to roost.
No. It's now visible in the infrastructure. And with Walt, good worker and
everything. Keep it up,
Walt.
One last point that I would make that Dr. Crompton made here to the advisory board is that it's one thing to do a survey and people to tell you that they support additional funding for parks, but he put a slide up there that shows that virtually every time a bond issue goes before the Texas voters or the national voters, it wins overwhelmingly. There were 8, I think he said, last year. Every one of them won by over 60% to buy parks. I mean, El Paso passed them 4 years ago, and it, I think, was the only one of the bond initiatives in El Paso that passed. So the people not only support them philosophically, they're willing to pay for them, and they're wondering, I think, what's going on.
Great presentation. Any more questions from Walt? I really endorse your view that this is the single most critical issue that this department faces.
Amen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Item number three, City Parks Advisory Committee update. Scott?
Chairman, Commissioners, my name is Scott Borup, Deputy Executive Director of Operations. I'm here today to give you a briefing on the State Park Advisory Board process and the meeting that happened last Friday. First of all, the chairman appointed this committee about 75 days ago. The committee has been in kind of a hurry-up-and-get-something-done mode. They've met twice in the last 2 months. The last meeting occurred last Friday. The first meeting had occurred about 30 days prior to that, and the staff was asked to present information, particularly financial information, about the state park system, what we currently have, what our current operating budget is, and what we think would be reasonable recommendations for additional funding to address the issues that Mr. Gavin just outlined. I will say that we also were given a pretty straight directive to make sure that what we came forward with was adequate but not excessive. So we really went through quite an extensive process. Mr. Dabney, Mr. Shally, all the regional directors met many, many times and kind of combed through what they would need to do this state park system well, but not excessively. So we came to the first meeting with some broad ranges of numbers. We hadn't had a lot of time to look at it. Mr. Monfort, the chairman of the advisory board, instructed us to go back to the drawing board and come back and work closely with his subcommittee on finance with some more closely honed numbers that didn't give such broad parameters. So in the meeting last, I will say that in the interim, we met, I'm going to say, probably five or six times with the subcommittee on finance. We provided them reams of data. We sat down with them many times and kind of looked at, really on a park-by-park basis, what the park leadership believed was necessary to run the parks appropriately. I will say that the ladies and gentlemen in the state parks leadership group have a combined 200-plus years in the state and federal park systems, and so I'm not sure you can find a better qualified group to sit down and say this is what we need in our state parks. The numbers that were rolled out last week, I'm going to kind of go through those. I did not prepare a slide. These were not hard recommendations from the subcommittee. These were just the latest numbers. We don't want to get a bunch of different sets of numbers floating around, but we do want to give you some idea of the numbers that are out there right now. We started out by kind of breaking down the numbers into some major categories that we thought were important. The first were our operating cost. We were going under the theory that it's always better to take care of what you've got before you look out and start getting something else, and that's been something that this commission has directed us over the last 5 or 6 years. So the first few items, which were high priority, were operating. How are we going to get enough staff? How are we going to get enough gasoline and toilet tissue and window panes and screens to take care of the system? Minor repairs were a critical piece, and as you saw up there, what kind of equipment would be necessary to take care of the state park system? The numbers that the subcommittee presented to the advisory committee last week go something like this. About $5.7 million in additional full-time classified staff. That's about 159 full-time equivalents that would be spread across the system. Many of them in positions we currently don't have, for example, law enforcement. We really have problems in that regard. You take a big park like Garner State Park, and it's a pretty dangerous scenario if you don't have law enforcement out there. So those are categories that there were some new staff in there. There is some restoration of staff that was reduced over the last 2 or 3 years in the operating budget. But the short story is there are about $5.7 million in classified employees full-time spread across the system. In addition to that, they reported a probable need of about $1.4 million in hourly or seasonal staff. As you probably are aware, it's about this time of year we start gearing up to go into the busy summer season. State Parks Division typically needs quite an influx of staff. So in addition to the 5.7 in classified, about $1.4 million was identified in classified part-time staff. Other operating, and that includes things like gasoline and paying utility bills. It's interesting to note that over the last 3 or 4 years, the utility increases of the state parks have exceeded 30% a year in many cases. Steel, for example, has gone up 100% in the last 6 months.
a lot of things that the parks use have gone through the roof. As Walt described, we were really looking at, we did an analysis over the last 4 years, and in the last 4 years alone, we were some $6 to $8 million in the hole relative to our ability to purchase ongoing operational equipment needs. We also identified about $2 million in other staff that support state parks. For example, infrastructure and the communications divisions and others have over the last 2 or 3 years taken pretty significant hits in an effort to shield state parks from the continuing deterioration that they're experiencing. Of course, this has affected our ability to support state parks. Infrastructure is the group that goes out and does the major capital repairs and oftentimes the smaller technical assistance. So we are identifying about $2 million in the other divisions in staff costs. Excuse me. The other main category in this operational group is equipment and the solid condition of most of the vehicles in state parks. They do average about 10 years old, many of them in excess of 120,000, 130,000 miles. Really not enough equipment to do just basic things like mowing the lawn. The number that came out from the subcommittee last week was about $6.6 million in additional equipment per year. Now, reminder as we go forward, these are numbers in addition to the existing budget in state parks. So if you take the 5.7 to 1.4 for hourly, about $4 million in minor repairs, and those are things like fixing a leak in the roof, as Commissioner Ramos addressed earlier, that is a key problem for us. We have historically, over the last few years, not had much minor repair money, and so small roof leaks in a couple of years turn into roof replacements and ceiling replacements and those kind of things. So we've identified an additional $4 million a year in minor repair needs. Those are our, for lack of a better term, our first tier of needs that we believe the state park systems need in order to take care of what we have. The second tier of really important financial needs are major repairs, and those are repairs which we described as capital repairs, but typically under our rules, items that cost $25,000 or more. And those are things like replacing water and wastewater systems. We have 255 water and wastewater systems across the system. When we went back and looked at an average replacement cost, about $1.5 million per system. So it just gives you an idea of the scope of the problem that we're facing. We believe that a $25 million a year major repair budget is conservative but reasonable. We have identified $400 to $500 million in critical, imminent repairs that are necessary. But we do believe that if we could come up with a consistent funding source that allowed us to gear up and stay geared up, we could be much more efficient. Just as a reminder, Proposition 8, which was approved three sessions ago. In the first session, we got some $32 million. In the second session, we got zero. This year, we got $18 million. And as businessmen, you can understand the difficulty in trying to gear up and gear down and gear up and gear down and try to keep going.
The $25 in addition to the bonded that we authority we have?
Yes, sir. We currently have $42 million, as clarification, remaining in the Prop 8 authority that has not been appropriated to the agency. We intend to go back this year and ask for most or all of that, and it's yet to be seen, of course, whether or not we'll get any or some piece of that. But the $25 million is indeed in addition to whatever current funding we have.
So that would... I just want to make that clear.
46
remaining?
Yes, sir.
Instead of 42?
Yes, that's correct. To move on, we currently have an MOU with the Texas Department of Transportation. And vis-a-vis that MOU, we get $5 million a year in road repairs under this contract. Now, that money does not come to the agency. We don't account for the money, and we don't bank it and spend it. That's under a direct MOU that the TxDOT provides directly to us. That has been the case for the last 10 years. We have currently about a $40 million plus backlog of road repairs. and didn't really reflect there, but there are many of the parks that folks are dodging some pretty significant chuck holes, and there are at least two parks I'm aware of where the park roads are falling off into the creek or lake or whatever.
Are you saying that MOU of $5 million is in the $15 million, or it would be in addition to the $15
million? We currently have a $5 million a year that we've been getting for 10 years. Under the proposal that was floated out last Friday, we would ask TxDOT for an additional $15 million a year on top of the guide.
So it would become 20?
Yes, sir. Every year. I think over time it would allow us to catch up. And, I think 15 is adequate. We did what we were asked to do, Commissioner, which was come up with numbers we believe would take care of the system, but wouldn't be outrageous numbers. And so I think over time we could catch up if we had $20 million a year. Yes, sir. The next category that we looked at was acquisition and development. As you gentlemen are aware, we have a land and water plan which envisions over 10 years the acquisition of at least 4 5,000 acre state parks within the so-called Golden Triangle between Houston, Dallas, and San Antonio. It also articulates the need to acquire additional wildlife management areas to represent some unique ecosystems that are currently unrepresented in the system. It also envisions us adding two existing parks in a way that makes sense. So the committee, through the subcommittee, asked us to come up with some ideas about how we could fulfill that vision. And as a result of that, the number that was recommended last week was $15 million a year over the next 10 years to try to fulfill the intent of the land and water plan. Now, I will say that the committee did take the time to say this wasn't a bold vision in their opinion, that they wished they could acquire more and do more, but given the marching orders, which was to see what it would take to fulfill the plan, this was the number they ultimately put on the table. The last number that was discussed last week were the local park grants, which you heard about here earlier. At one point, those park grants were getting $15.5 million of the Sporting Goods sales tax. They also were earning some interest, and occasionally we had other funds, federal funds, we could match against them. So that at one point, several years ago, the local park grant system had almost $20 million a year to hand out to local entities. That number has been reduced to just over $5 million in this last budget cycle. So the committee, subcommittee proposed to the committee an additional, on top of the current $5 million, an additional $20 million a year for local park grants. I believe the thinking was there that kind of gets them back to even, given all these inflation spiraling cost increases. I think the subcommittee felt if you could get them back to 25, it would be kind of equivalent to where they were at before at 20. So, the short story on all that, commissioners, is that the subcommittee recommended some additional $100 million and some change if we want to put the park system back into reasonable condition and be able to maintain it at the level we could be proud of. Part of the presentation was to point out that currently we are capped at $32 million under the Sporting Goods sales tax authorization. In the last budget cycle, we were approved about $20 million of the $32 million. Having said that, I think that represents the happenings last week at the advisory board meeting.
You know what I'd like to the
estimated amount is this year, I believe, $104 million.
Yeah, that's the 20 out of 1.2 only appropriated. That's
comptroller's. If the comptroller's estimate, and it probably is worth articulating for just a moment. You know, there is no hard number that says we sell that many sporting goods. That's an estimate that the comptroller makes every year, and it has been increasing yearly. This year, I believe, it's just over $104 million.
Does not include footwear, right?
I'm not sure of the answer to
that. Gentlemen, I'd like to make one point here. We've worked on this a long time. We started on this back last fall, and we've gone through a number of different gyrations. Walt and his crew have done a great job. Scott's Gene, all of us have. I want to point out to you something that, like, when it
when it gets around to me, and when I start looking at these kind of numbers and the things that I want you to catch on. Probably our most valuable asset in our state parks and region is our people. Most valuable thing that we've got are people that work out there in this park. Go back up there and look at those numbers that Scott laid out in his book. 159 full-time employees at 5.78. Don't take long to do the math on what that is per employee. Full-time, year employee, $35,000. We're not talking about squad. If we were in a position to do so, we would try to completely reclass our park people. Most of our park people are paid below what they should be for the jobs they do. We're not in a position to do that right now. That's $35,000 per full-time employee. If you look at the seasonals, the part-times, that's 70 FTEs at 1.4 million. That's $20,000, if you think of it on an annual basis. So when we say to the committee, to the legislators, to the folks that we work with downtown, and to you, we tried to keep this budget reasonable. We tried to keep it within the framework. We don't believe in squat. I think that's about the best example that I can give. There's no squat. 159 people, 114 parks. That's not piling a whole bunch of people in very many parks. So those are the kind of things that I...
114.
Yes, sir.
We've reduced about 100 FTEs over the last 4 years out of the division. So when we look at it that way, it's really only an addition of about 59 FTEs over what we were even 3 years ago. And we were not in good shape then.
A lot of times it's hard for people who don't explore those kind of numbers a lot to understand that you're just building a whole lot of people and a whole lot of high-paid folks. I hope that you follow that.
Thank you.
Just now, we need 100 million
in addition.
Is that? I didn't understand that that was in addition. I understood it to be taken from the current funding level.
That's in addition to current budget. That was the instruction we were asked by the committee.
What, Chairman, I was not for the first meeting, but for the second, but Chairman Monford, I think, paraphrasing his words correctly, was that give me the real number of what this cost of these years of deferment are going to cost us to get where we need to be. And it's, see, you're doing two jobs at once. You're bringing things back up to where they need to be. Plus, and I've reiterated this, plus, you have to meet the goals set out in the 10-year plan.
So really,
that's why the numbers staggering. It's because you're not starting from zero. You're starting from behind the line to get to that goal. And I think he's right. That's probably not a realistic number in the beginning, but that's why you need a long-term plan. Get out of this on the road to the
when you have a system this size and you have deferred maintenance for 5 or 6 or 7 years, it's going to cost more. You said $400 to $500 million in deferred maintenance. Mr. Parker?
I have two questions. First of all, will this proposal, $105.45 million, let's say we got it, how does it reflect on the 5% reduction in the 77th, the 13% reduction in the 78th, and the 5% reduction in the 79th, which is 23%? Does that represent, or does that bring us up to where we were in the 76th? You understand what I mean?
I do believe I understand what you mean, Commissioner. I don't have a clean answer for you.
Okay, but I mean, could we get? I think that's very
important. It puts us in considerably better condition.
I realize that, but I think it would give us additional comparative.
But we were still deferring maintenance at the time of the first cut.
That's the reason why I want to know.
We're moving targets.
We can get some numbers for you there. I suspect, I would say, Senator Cook, we will be in much better shape than we were whatever year you want to pick.
And then my second question. Thank you. That's the first. My second question is, does this 100.45 million include necessary funding for the Texas State Railroad?
This funding includes funding for the Texas State Railroad at the static display beginning in February of next year.
So it does not include...
does not envision the railroad moving on the tracks next year.
Okay. That's what I wanted to know.
And just for the record, Scott, what do you... If it did include the railroad moving on both roads, it would add... How much would you add to that?
We believe over the 10 years, which is, by the way, these numbers are all based on a 10-year vision, it would add approximately $40 to $45 million to the price tag. And it might be slightly higher than that. But with the last look we took, which was about 9 months ago, I believe the number was about $45 million.
Over 10 years?
Yes, sir.
So we're talking about
I recall it was about $6 million in the first 3 or 4 years, then decreased to $5 million for 3 or 4, and then decreased to $4 million for 3 or 4.
Okay.
I think that's correct. We can get that
now. You got to dig out of that hole, too.
That's right. So an additional hole. That most of that $4 or $5 million, or a lot of that, I would say, a majority of the $4 or $5 or $6 million a year is in capital improvements to the railroad. There's only about $1.5 million or $2 million a year in additional operating costs. So this $25 million number that we floated out here does not include that $3 or $4 million a year in capital improvements to the railroad, nor does the budget that we rolled out.
Okay, now a sub question.
Yes, sir.
After that, how much of this proposed budget would go into the battleship Texas, realizing from past meetings that we had numbers thrown out to us that we expect from the ISP, a federal, which is actually Texas tax, gasoline tax dollars coming back to us, with that ISP item to be $16 million available from the battleship Texas, and then $12 million from the legislature, which is $28 million. And the last repair figure that I heard on the battleship Texas was $48 million, so that leaves us $10 million shy. Where does that $10 million come out of this budget, this $100
million? It does not. There's two components there, Commissioner. The component I believe you're talking about is the capital repair component. Indeed, the legislature, by the way, the program now is called SAFE-T, not ICT anymore. They changed the name for some reason. Out of the SAFE-T program, they appropriated directed $16.1 million, I believe. Yes, that's correct. Out of that safety program. We also, out of Proposition 8, were directed to spend $12 million and some change.
Which we don't have yet.
Which we do not have, and we have to come up with a match. And so the answer to your question is we are still struggling with how we're going to come up with a match. Now, the other part of your question was how much would it take to repair the battleship. There are several proposals on the table. The least expensive one could probably be covered with the money that we currently have, assuming we can find a match. That would be the least desirable solution because it would require you to tow the battleship, spend $20 or $30 million, tow it back, set it in the mud, and let it rot again for 10 years.
And you had to do that in the same boat.
We in the agency don't think that's a wise way to do it. We are proposing a $45 million fix, $48 million. We don't have the hard number yet. We have not done the engineering. We are moving forward with some engineering studies that will give us some of the answers to allow us to come up with a hard number. But we do believe it would be in excess of $40 million, maybe closing in on $50 million, ultimately, to do it right, which would require us to move the ship out, build, in essence, a dry berth, move the ship back in, get the water out from an ungristle over time. You only have normal maintenance and not the maintenance that accrues with the saltwater burden.
Mm-hmm. But just to clarify, I wasn't sure I understood the answer to your question. Does the $100 million include the repairs to the battleship or the rebirth into the battleship?
Any of it.
When you came up with the number, did you allocate a certain amount to the battleship?
No. We're still stuck with that.
Well, we still had that unfunded.
Well, part of the issue, Commissioners, is obviously if we get $25 million, it will be your decision by and large where you want us to put some of that money, and many times the legislature will tell us where they want us to spend some of it too. So we try to come up with a reasonable middle-of-the-road figure and would depend on yours and the legislature's direction as to how we might spend some of that money.
My other part of comment on the battleship, as you heard me say before, it was not serving in the Texas Navy. And I believe there should be some efforts made for the
to give it back to the federal, United States
for some federal funding. Saying it's serving the United States.
And Congressman Ted Poe has worked on that, as you know. If somehow we inveigle so that you can get it to us, because I can afford that.
My name wasn't on that.
my only comment.
But does not go on the commission in 48?
I'm sorry?
Were you on the commission in 48?
No, I think I was barely born. No, my only comment is I think we need to work on the battleship, but I think we have a more pressing problem that will impact the entire state with the park system. So my emphasis would be there, not that we ignore the battleship. That would be my idea.
Well, and I think that's what this presentation to the committee last week addressed. Really, was the entire park system without identifying major capital allocations to either the battleship or the railroad.
Well, for purposes of the exercise, you know, I at least want you to understand, we purposefully pulled out a lot of the capital. We pulled out the capital pieces for the railroad that I described. We did not specifically include more capital dollars for the battleship. We really kind of looked at more of the normal day-to-day operating and normal capital expenses, not these behemoth projects, because they really, I mean, if you want $45 million more for the railroad and you want $45 million more for the battleship, now you're doubling the number in one fell swoop.
Right.
But we really believe over time, those are the kind of projects that would really benefit from a bonding program. We're talking about on a regular normal, replace the roof and, you know, put in, you know, a new slab, and when the tornado knocks it down, fix the walls kind of capital. These kind of big projects really kind of stand aside, in our opinion.
That's a good point. That's a very good point.
Just so you all get an idea of where we're going, it is easy for us. Well, it's an exercise that Chairman Mons is asking to go through. But I think he's exactly right. Because oftentimes, once we get into the legislative process, too many of these what-if questions are asked at the last minute. And he's trying to go through this exercise now, a year ahead, so the final product is everybody's thinking on the same sheet of music. What's always here from this period. I got to tell you, there were some staff folks, legislative staff folks, who I've invited and coached to come to this meeting. So that was last one a little shock, that number. And one caught me in the hall and said, how long is this going to go on? And I said, well, I mean, the need for parts. And I explained that you are getting out of the ditch first. I said, but I'm not getting out of the ditch. I said, it'll last as long as we decide to grow. And they looked at me, what? Yeah, you got to look at heart as an investment and a need that is commensurate with your economic growth, same as any other infrastructure.
Right.
I think we're still, we're ways before we get to that hurdle, but as both of them, an excellent job of pointing out the economic
development component, but it cannot be seen as a finish line. As long as you're growing, you need a park system that's able to grow.
Well, and there's a park budget that is required regardless.
Right.
Right. If you're going to open parks and operate parks, you have to have a budget to do that, and you've got to take care of that infrastructure.
And if the state's going to grow, you have to grow.
Well, it's going to have to get bigger if you're going to grow. But we have 114 in the taken care of now.
Well, look at it this way. You look at the map that, not Crompton, but the state demography, Murdoch? They start showing the maps of suburban, ex-urban growth, and you realize that every time that happens, you need more local parks. And then at some point, you need another state park. And you tie those two together, and you realize that it's not a, unless you're encouraging us to stop economic growth, you're not going to stop.
It's in the 10-year plan that you helped write.
Exactly.
When you have some hard decisions.
Monster told them to next meeting.
July the 14th is the next meeting of the advisory committee, and my understanding is Mr. Monster wants to put together a report immediately following that meeting, which would usher people up.
The governor's office has asked for a report the end of July, first week of August.
Aspect of this into private dollars.
Yes.
Did you discuss that? You had a subcommittee on that.
There are other items. One of the things they are looking at is other sources of funding, not just private, but any other sources of money, private being one of those. We have made some preliminary efforts within the agency to look at those opportunities and to continue to do so. I will say that in general, they've not been very successful because folks really don't want to fund operations too much. They're not going to build a building now and then, but it's very difficult to get somebody to get money to fund operations. Cleaning bathrooms is a hard one. Yes.
Well, so that's a really good point, Robert. We don't have the money to operate them and they give it to us.
Yeah. Incredible, Joseph. It's sad. Sad. One point of clarification. You may hear a number of $122 million that came out of the meeting last week, which is different from the number I just reported to you. Just wanted to make sure you understood. I do believe the committee and the staff working together came up with $100 million, $102 million number in that range. The way the information was presented in summary at the end of the meeting last week was a little bit confusing because it added to that number the $20 million that we already get in 40-year sales tax. And so the way the number was presented, I did get some calls. Some folks were confused, particularly some press were confused about the number. And so if you hear the $122 million, that's the difference. That $122 million, I think what they were trying to do is organize the information to kind of say, if we were going to go for the sporting goods sales tax, here's the sporting goods sales tax hit, which would be 100 if 102 is a good number, then it would be given this year's 20.
Scott, it would be helpful to me, and I suspect others, if we would take the presentation that was made to the committee, it totals $100,433,000, and add to that that which we already received. We then allocate that through the various items so that we can see what that total budget is rather than just the annals, because we're not sure what we're adding it to.
So we see
what that total is.
We've had the same request from several legislators, so we're working on that.
So, I'm going to get a surprise.
Well, that is the goal at the very end. Everybody
understands exactly what we're doing.
I want to reiterate that what's happening right now at that advisory committee and advisory subcommittee level is an exercise. We run out of there with any of those numbers and say, this is the number because it's based on some assumptions and very broad questions from the chairman of that advisory committee, Monster, wanting to know the potential broadest and reach of the meeting.
There was no recommendation. In fact, that was made pretty clear during the meeting. These were not recommendations. It was just an exercise to kind of hone the numbers down as Mr. Monster had requested.
That committee that I appointed, there's
got some real horsepower. People are really understanding this. They have Montford, Alexander, former member of the House, Andy, of course, former executive director, Al Henry, our former commissioner, and Paul Ferg, and Texas Ferg, and so it's just a great group.
And we appreciate the work they're doing.
Some of them, I don't think really. Monsters put them to work,
let me put it
that way.
We thank you.
Is that right, Diane? Especially the worst.
Any further questions for Scott? Thank you very much, Scott. Item number four.
This is nearly taking as long as the regulation.
Item number four, legislative review.
Mr. Cook and Mary Taylor.
All right. I think we'll talk a little about our legislative process and where we are. Usually in the spring of the year, prior to the session, here within the various divisions, we start talking about legislative issues, statute changes, whatever it is that we may be looking at, and that we will be coordinating very closely with you as we go through the summer. Our legislative appropriation request, the official document that lays out our request we submit, and fortunately Mary is here to help us get through this, but we submit that request in early to mid-August, when that document must go in. So it will be pretty well finished by mid-July. And so we're trying to stay in sync with this advisory committee, because obviously part of their work is going to be an integral part of our legislative appropriation request. Mary, I think you might click on the slide for me. The basic issues, we always have from each division, we may have seven or eight different legislative issues that they bring up. But what I want to focus on this time is what we've all agreed that we want to keep it pretty straightforward. There are several key issues. Number one, top of the list, state park funding needs, and I'm not going to spend any more time on that. You can tell that we're very deep in that process of developing those numbers. Justification behind those numbers ends up in a three-ring notebook about that thick on each park, each site. Folder on the major repair needs for the future. Capital equipment replacement needs, and that's general revenue and Fund 9. There again, you're talking trucks, everything from garbage trucks to patrol vehicles for our law enforcement people, trucks for our wildlife guys, fishery guys to haul fish in, computer equipment, a lot of our information technology, the equipment involved in that is behind times, and we have struggled with our funding issues to keep up with that. Boats, those are the kind of issues that you see on those lists, and the Fund 9 part of that kind of issue is we have funds available, but they just haven't been appropriated. And that's an area that we're, again, really going to talk to them about, folks who pay these revenues for the hunting and fishing licenses, and here's our need, here's our justification, and we hope to pull some of that out. The one on law enforcement is one that you've seen from me every session, and that involves the work that our game wardens and park police officers do, but particularly game wardens. They are certified Texas police officers. That means if they encounter some sort of major violation, they're not stopping people for running stop signs or going 75 miles an hour. If they run into violence, they run into robbery, they run into some real major problem, by law, they are required to stop and assist and try to shut that operation down and get it set, by law. In addition, our homeland security issues have just continued to increase. And, for instance, the emergency response that you heard and saw about and you'll hear more about to Katrina and Rita. Now, those folks, those men and women, their salaries are paid by hunting and fishing licenses, the revenue collected. We need some GR to offset a small percentage, maybe a couple, $3 million in that range, to offset part of this other law enforcement
responsibilities and duties that they have. The Pittman Robertson funding that we get in the agency basically makes the promise that we will spend hunting and fishing license dollars on hunting and fishing and wildlife and those kinds of things. If you're spending hunting and fishing license dollars, which these men and women, these officers are paid with, then you're in violation of that rule as far as Pittman Robertson, DJ, and those kinds of things. So there are funds, $25, $26 million at risk every time we go there. Now, for instance, before we went into New Orleans, we received approval from Washington for that exercise, for that time. We hope to get some of that back through FEMA, but that remains to be seen. Freshwater fishery stamp revenue, again, Fund 9 income coming in from freshwater fishery stamp, running about $5 to $6 million a year, looks like. We need that money appropriated so that we can do the work that, that we committed to do with that revenue. Can't use that revenue anywhere else. Can only be used for that. And so we're going to ask to bring that money all forward so that we can use it as it comes in on the various projects that we've got across the state. Making good progress on East Texas Hatchery. You'll hear more about that. Miscellaneous riders. We get the opportunity for some sort of omnibus bill or piece by piece as appropriations process goes through. Rider 27, which allowed us to, as Walt so accurately pointed out, we generated more money than was projected. Rider 27 allowed us to use that, both in Fund 9 and in Fund 64. We've done well there. It was very helpful. We'll try to get that again. That will have to be renewed. That will have to be restated in some manner. And a little item there, just to give you a feel for meals for TDCJ. All those volunteer workers, the community service workers, the TDCJ guys, we can't buy them a lunch. Somehow, we have to either through the foundation, through donations, through some wrangle-jangle method, find a way to buy lunch for those dozens, hundreds, whatever it is, people that come to the various parks of Ogden and various fish hatcheries across the state. The current rules prohibit us from doing that, from buying a $5 lunch for those guys. So we're going to see if we can get that addressed. We have an indication that we might get some help there. That's kind of just a real quick shot at the progress.
Just you may want to explain, not to make any words, but you mentioned the diversion issues of completing the emergency work. There's also the environmental and forestry cleanup, and that's what you need to do.
Well, in that interpretation, TCEQ, yeah, we do some skills and spills and that kind of stuff. They refund, they pay us $500,000 a year. They provide us $500,000 a year through appropriation process. So there is
a direct from TCEQ, or that's part of our, is earmarked as part of the appropriation as well?
Yeah, because it's funded through them on an MOU.
Yeah. And do we think that that
yes.
is a regional officer?
It covers it. Yes, it does. Yes, it does. Next. Statutory changes, as you know, the chairman is serving on the Environmental Flows Committee, one of our big issues, environmental flows for streams and bays. That probably should say environmental flows for fish and wildlife. That's where we are. That's who we are. And we're working on that inside the agency, chairman working through the appointed committee. Our license structure cleanup, Dr. McKinney and all the division directors have worked through the year to look for ways to clean up our licensing system. Not sure yet that that's going to take any statute change in legislation, but it might. Lastly there, just another one of those kind of by-the-way things of interest. Our volunteers, that same group of people that you're talking about there, they get out in the park. They are not covered insurance-wise by any of the state insurance. So we'd be looking for protection for them. While they're working in the park, while they're doing things, let's say they're pulling a wagon, a hayride, or something like that, or assisting a group of kids on a tour or swimming event, you know, wherever it might be, they are subject to personal liability as it stands right now. So we'd like to get that. That's just a quick shot at it, and we will certainly be back with you almost continuously through the summer.
as we approach this and working with the finance committee very closely as we're doing this.
Good morning, Commissioners. For the record, I'm Mary Fields, Chief Financial Officer. As part of the legislative preview, I'm here to provide an update on the strategic plan and the legislative appropriations request for LAR. In the last meeting, we reviewed the background requirements and process for preparing the strategic plan, and I reviewed some proposed changes to our budget strategies and performance measures. You'll recall these changes have to be negotiated with the Legislative Budget Board and the Governor's Office. We met with the Legislative Budget Board staff in mid-April, and all of our proposed changes were approved, with the exception of the deletion of one performance measure. We were requesting that the measure for the number of local assistance planning project requests fulfilled be deleted because that formal program has been discontinued due to budget reductions. We were advised that local parks may receive some funding in the future, which could reinstate that program, so it was preferred that the measure stay in place. We concurred with this response and really appreciated the time Legislative Budget Board staff spent with us working through our proposed changes. We received final approval from both the Governor's Office and the Legislative Budget Board just a couple of days ago. The actual draft of the strategic plan has been reviewed by the staff and the executive team and is ready for commission review. I believe Carol just handed you a draft of the plan a little bit earlier today. And we'll look for any review comments from you by June 5th. The actual plan is due on July the 7th. That's where we are with that. Moving on to the LAR, you'll recall I mentioned that our base budget for our fiscal year 2008-2009 request is based on projected expenditures from fiscal year 2006 and our FY 2007 operating budget. We are currently in the process of preparing our 2007 operating budget as it helps to establish our base. So that's where our main focus is right now. We have not yet received the instructions yet to prepare the LAR. Normally we receive those instructions in late April or early May. If they have not yet been released. The instructions include the actual due date for our LAR, but as Bob mentioned, it's normally due the first or second week of August, and we are on target to meet that deadline. That concludes my comments for this agenda item. Are there any questions? Well, I will move to the
number five.
Okay, to the next agenda.
Special overview.
Then for the record, Mary Fields, CFO, here to provide the financial overview. The focus of our presentation will be to provide a revenue and budget status through March of fiscal year 2006 and to update you on the results of the State Auditor's Office audit of Fund 9. Let's start with revenue and budget. When comparing state parks gross receipts through March 31st at $15.65 million, we're at 5.5% or $809,000 over last year's collection. In reviewing the categories of park receipts, all of the categories exceed the prior year at this time except for facilities and miscellaneous revenues. Facilities are currently behind by less than 1% at $33,000 and miscellaneous revenue is down by $36,000. The concession revenue is fairly close to last year's receipts, while entrance fees are up 8.5% and park pass sales are up 29% from the prior year. So overall, we continue to do well with revenues in our state parks, and we hope to see this trend continue throughout the year. Our boat revenue as of March 31st is at $7.4 million. This is down by 9.9% or $813,000 compared to last year at the same time. There are decreases in all the categories of revenue. Revenue for boat registrations is down by 14%, titles issued is down by 2.2%, and sales tax revenue is down by 1.5%. We believe these decreases are due to lake and waterway levels being down because of drought conditions, and combined with that increased gas prices that we've been hearing about. Hopefully, this is as of March, so hopefully some of the rains that we received in April and May that have helped the lake levels will turn this downward trend around. We'll just watch it closely. We do continue to transfer 15% of registration and titling revenue to Fund 64, which amounts to $954,000 based on revenues through March. Our license sale revenue is also down as of the end of March. At $71.7 million, we're down $1.6 million in revenues as compared to last year, or 2.2%. Combo revenue is down 1.8%. Fishing is down by 10.3%. Hunting is slightly up at 2.8%, and the other category is up by 4%. We'll continue to watch the fishing license revenues, which are showing a turn for the better. At the lowest point, we were 12% behind. Here I'm reporting as of the end of March, we're at 10%, and current reports as of mid-May are showing we're behind by a little over 7%. So we are seeing the gap close with these license revenues, and which is a good sign. In reviewing the number of licenses sold, at 2.2 million, we're down 1% as of the end of March. Hunting is down 3.1%, which does not correlate with that revenue category we just talked about. You'll recall that the non-resident licenses sold was up, and that's what drove the revenue up in this area. Fishing is down by 10.5%, which pretty closely correlates with the numbers, with the revenue numbers. And total combo sales are up 1.6% when compared to last year's sales this time. Now, the number of combo licenses sold, again, it includes our military super combos, that count, and those do not bring in revenue. So while we see a slight increase in the number of super combos sold, the actual revenue is actually down 2%. Overall, you know, we're continuing to gain ground slowly in this area, so we'll continue to watch it closely. Mm-hmm.
Am I remembering correctly that we got behind on essentially in the hurricane season, the Katrina and Rita?
Yes.
All right, and we're just slowly picking that up. It's not a trend from the previous year.
No, it's not. And it was at the 12% range. That was in the September-October time frame, which was just right after the hurricane. So we are gaining ground.
What about the monthly? What about like what was the last month? March 31st.
That was March 31st.
This is March 31st. Yeah.
How does March compare to March and February to January and December to December?
I pulled March numbers for you, and as of last month. And these aren't total, let's see, best I can do here, I have kind of total revenues. It's not broken down by the fishing. In our last report, we were talking about total sales revenue being down by 2.5%.
March to March.
No, that was last month. Now, a year ago, we were actually 6% ahead of where we were at in 2004. So
definitely were 04.
We were in 05, we were up over 04, and now we're slightly down from where we were in 05.
Month to month?
That's a yearly average.
But you can't, you don't have the figures.
I do have figures.
April to April, March to March, February.
Let me give you something that can help, Sean.
Okay.
We started out 12% behind from Katrina, Rita, primarily Rita.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of March, we were 10% behind. Today, as of last week, we're 7%.
Okay.
And by just the math of that, the April number would have been, or 06 would have been ahead of 05 in order to close that gap. And so we're making up the ground, which means that the linked month of April, 05-06, and we did better than
tickets from 10% to 5%
or to 7%. 7.2, I think is what you told us. So it's, and that, to move the dial that much in, is about 6 weeks, right? Because it was as of last week or so. That's a pretty big movement.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because you're moving from September 1.
Right.
Sure.
And so it could take 6 weeks to move 6 months.
Well, it's what she just said and what you say just proves that these minus figures that we're in are hurricane related.
Right, exactly. And the recent rains have caused people to have more fishing licenses.
Even in West Texas.
Yeah, everywhere.
Commissioner, I do have.
That's okay. You answered it good. Okay. You answered it good.
Okay. When comparing our, moving on to revenue collections, when comparing our fiscal year 2006 revenue collections as of March 31st to the annual revenue estimate, we're progressing as expected in all of the funds, with the exception of Fund 9, which is no surprise. With 58% of the year elapsed, we've collected 63% of our Fund 9 Game Fish and Water Safety Fund. If you compare it at this same time last year, we collected 70% of our estimate. So, again, we're seeing some of the impact of the revenue decreases relating to boat revenue that I talked about, and also the license revenue when compared to the prior year. And let me just mention, while comparing to the prior year is a good gauge for our progress, the real concern here is that we meet the revenue estimate. And for this fund, I've looked at it with this recent boat revenue information. It's looking like we're going to be pretty close. So we will be watching it, you know, as I stated, very closely. And I guess that's enough said there. The remainder of the funds with us are with 54.6% collected for state park funds, 73% for the local park fund, and 56.3% for the other category. Those really are progressing as they should be. We'll see the state park fund pick up in the summer. So, in reviewing our fiscal year 2006 budget versus expense, you can see that our budget is at $316.8 million, and we have $169.8 million, or 53.6% of the budget remaining, with 42% of the fiscal year remaining. Salaries, grants, and benefits, as you can see, those are pretty much on track. Operating and equipment is showing 51.9% of the budget still available. In reviewing that category, there are some subcategories such as consumable supplies and utilities that have a higher portion of the budget remaining, but we typically see those categories drop off more during the summer. We are showing 67.7% of the capital projects available. Again, we've got several projects in progress, and this balance will continue to decline as the year progresses. Our overall budget has increased by $8.9 million since February 28th. Mid-year budget adjustments were made during the month of March, and they are summarized on this slide. The miscellaneous adjustments of $7.7 million include bringing in Rider 27 funds of $7.1 million. We have not budgeted all of that Rider 27 funding yet. We are holding back about $1.4 million of Fund 9, and we want to do that as we watch our revenue estimates. And also, those funds are tied to the request to exceed our capital authority and that we discussed the last meeting, and that hasn't been approved yet. So we're holding off on that. We have heard, I mean, the oversight agencies have been pretty focused on the special session, but we are hopeful that that approval of our request to exceed that capital authority will be approved. The grant adjustments at $1.3 million include one sizable grant for over $946,000 for the State Recreational Boating Safety Program. The last adjustment on the slide relates to our transfer of the Nimitz to the Texas Historical Commission effective November 1st. According to our agreement, we will transfer funds to the Historical Commission over a four-year period, with each year declining by 25%, basically to assist with the transition of that museum. Next, I want to provide an update on the results of the State Auditor's Office audit of Fund 9. Overall, we feel the auditors have some favorable conclusions by stating that we have effective processes for collecting hunting and fishing license revenue and boat registration and titling fees. There were certain controls that they wanted to see improved, and I'll review those recommendations in the next few slides. While the state auditor states the department collected substantially all license fees and boat registration and titling fees and related taxes, improving certain controls would ensure we collect all of the license fees. They found that some resident licenses were sold to what appeared to be non-residents, and some individuals paid reduced license fees when they did not meet the age eligibility requirements. The auditors were recommending that we ask license agents to require proof of residency upon the purchase of a license and also determine that the individual is eligible for the type of license they are purchasing at the counter. While we understand the merit of this recommendation, and we will consider asking purchasers to show a driver's license to help, Texas driver's license, to help determine Texas residency, we plan to make system improvements in the next implementation of our license system to address the rest of the issues in lieu of attempting to enforce all of these provisions of the counter with our license agents. The other recommendation in this area was technical in nature. The auditors want us to be able to produce a list of active agents for a particular time period, the time frame they were auditing. By maintaining a list with active start and end dates, we can ensure that fees from all active agents were collected. Again, we will pursue a list of this nature in the next license implementation. In related to sales here, the auditors are also recommending that we comply with all state and federal laws by ensuring that license applicants provide social security numbers and harvest information program certification when required at the time of purchase. Again, in lieu of attempting to enforce these provisions at the counter, we plan to design our upcoming system to require all necessary customer information at the time of sale. At times, some of these rules can be very complex, and we believe that they can be most effectively enforced by correcting the programming of all of the rules within the current system. The next recommendation was to ensure that net receipts from the sale of stamps are allocated to the dedicated funds associated with each stamp. Specifically, they're asking us to define net receipts to allocate revenue from Super Combo license revenue to the dedicated stamp funds. Gene has a presentation that will follow mine that will provide more detail on this specific recommendation, along with our management's proposal to address it. We were also asked to establish a restricted fund for the saltwater sport fishing stamp. We've addressed that already in fiscal year 2006. And they found some technical errors in our funding allocation table, and these issues have already been corrected. Next, while the auditors found we adequately monitor our license sales system, there were a few controls here that needed improvement. We need to require the contractor, in this case Verizon, to strengthen their disaster recovery plan and their password controls. We've met with Verizon staff, and those recommendations are being addressed. There is also a technical recommendation that we use a more statistical process in our sample testing of our license agent records, and we're addressing that recommendation. The next recommendation is to improve our procedures for monitoring license agents that sell licenses on our behalf. The auditors are recommending we develop an audit program to monitor agents' compliance with contract requirements and that we audit high-volume, high-risk agents. They also recommend we discontinue allowing licensed agents to decline monitoring. Currently, we oversample if we don't, and so we end up getting enough information from the agents to go on, but there was some concern about us allowing agents to decline. And so we are working on that to impact the statistical validity. Finally, credit the license agent's accounts only after receiving voided or misprinted licenses. Currently, they void automatically in 45 days, whether we have the actual voided documents. So we are working to improve that, actually extending that automatic credit to a 90-day time period. So we're working again with the system to address that issue. finally getting to some of the more positive results where the auditors found that we have adequate controls to ensure that expenditures from Fund 9 comply with the applicable restrictions and that we fully or substantially implemented 80% of the prior audit recommendations tested. The recommendations outstanding relate to that Social Security number issue that I talked about and our methodology to allocate revenue to the dedicated stamp funds, and we have some proposals there. Overall, generally, management agrees with the findings in the report, and as I've stated throughout the presentation, we are addressing the recommendations. Some of them are through modifications to the next license system. And we are addressing the allocation of super combo sales receipts to the stamp funds and defining the net receipts. And Gene has that presentation to address that recommendation, so I will pass it over to him.
We work on this allocation regularly, don't we?
Yes, sir. I'll give you a little history of it.
Yeah, there's a lot of history
of the allocation.
There's quite a bit of history to this.
Mr. Chairman, Commissioners, for the record, my name is Gene McCarty. I'm Deputy Executive Director for Administration. As Mary's discussed, the state auditors recently completed their audit of Fund 9. That's our game, fish, and water safety account. One of the issues that was identified is the allocation of receipts associated with the licenses and stamps that are components of the super combo. First, let me give you a little background on this issue. The Super Combo was originally created in 1996. This license was created as a one-stop shopping opportunity and a value license. I mean, it was a discounted license. The Super Combo was created by taking the existing combo license and adding all of the available stamps at a discounted price. The revenue allocation at that time was done on a do-no-harm policy. Basically, what that says is that that dedicated stamp funds were allocated at least as much revenue as they had been receiving prior to the creation of the Super Combo. In 2001, the state auditor did a Fund 9 audit. That was the audit that Mary was referring to, that we had completed 80% of the findings. The finding of that audit that relates to this issue is that there was not a commission-approved and documented allocation methodology for revenues associated with the dedicated stamps contained within the Super Combo. In response to this finding, the department developed the Super Combo allocation methodology. This methodology was presented to the commission and adopted as part of your commission budget policy. And just as a reminder, what we did was we basically defined the universe of stamp users using a number of existing surveys, using the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Survey of hunters and fishermen, using small game surveys, the Wildlife Division small game survey. From that universe, we subtracted the direct purchasers, those individuals who purchased a stamp in a direct method, not as a part of a combo license package. The remaining part of that user group was allocated to the super combo. Using that methodology that we presented to you several years ago, that you adopted, and that we've applied to the last few license years, this is how you would see the allocation of license revenue within the super combo for last year. This is exactly how it was allocated. This is what went on the books for FY05. In the most recent Fund 9 audit, there were a number of findings related to the super combo allocation. The one that I wish to address here today is the one that says that we should define net receipts for each dedicated stamp in the super combo package and allocate revenues in accordance with that definition. little variation, a little twist on the previous finding. Also, however, I want to point out another point, and is that in the auditor's report, they also had some discussion about using a direct proportional allocation methodology. That is basically that you take a percentage of the discount and apply it to each stamp independent of usage. While this is probably the easiest, simplest, quickest allocation methodology, we don't believe that it provides a fair and accurate and equitable allocation of these funds to the dedicated stamps. Just as a case in point, there's so much information here, I couldn't get it all on one slide, so I'm going to flip back and forth here. But that's how the allocation would look if you, and we looked at two different ways. First of all, allocating it proportionally by stamp price. So obviously the saltwater stamp is the most expensive stamp out there, so it gets considerably more money. Or allocating it independent of price. Well, all of these are equally unfair to somebody. So we
and the saltwater stamp's out of whack because it is proportionately larger, what, almost more expensive.
It's a $10 stamp, the freshwater stamp is a $5 stamp.
By factor two. Okay.
So if you look at the methodology that we're using right now, which is based on usage, you see this kind of it's based on both usage and price, because you get the number of people who you believe are using that stamp that are a component of the super combo, and multiply that number by the price, as compared to this proportional allocation methodology that the auditors they haven't actually proposed it. They just kind of discussed it in the text. Based on the state auditor's report, the current state auditor's report, we would recommend that the commission define net receipts in the administrative code. That means we would request that we publish in the Texas Register a definition of net receipts for you to adopt in an open public meeting. As the value calculated from relative weighting using both the price of the stamp and the purchaser use as established by a dedicated survey. One other point that the state auditors brought up is that this survey data was, first of all, not dedicated. It was designed for the purpose of identifying super combo stamp users, and it is somewhat dated because these surveys only go once every 4 years, once every 5 years. So they believe that data is dated and maybe not be as accurate. And we would like, and we have, created a super combo survey team here within the agency, probably in an effort to try to address this answer once and for all. We probably have the most talented team to address this team that we've ever put together. I want to introduce them. Jeremy Leach from Coastal Fisheries, John Taylor from Inland Fisheries, Mark Steinbach from Wildlife, and Sally Williams from Communications. Y'all will stand up and be identified. These guys are the best of the best. And we have been working on the design of a dedicated super combo survey, the implementation of the survey, the final analysis of the survey, and to give us the proportional allocation, or at least the allocation as based on this definition of net receipt, if you choose to publish it and ultimately adopt it.
If you've taken this recommendation and applied it to the numbers that you had on the screen on the previous couple of slides,
we don't think it's going to change a whole lot.
Some of those numbers were a bit different.
Oh, you mean to the proportional?
Well, you had three different ones, right?
This is as we allocate now, and it's user based.
Right.
Based on these surveys, which are not dedicated, not specifically designed to address this issue. This is proportional allocation, which has nothing to do with user or anything else. It just basically applies the total number of stamps purchased
Okay.
By percentage.
If you took the recommendation,
right,
and applied it to 05 and I guess 06,
right,
where would that fall?
We don't believe that it's going to look too much different than this. It's going to be a few thousand here, a few thousand there, but I don't think it's going to look too much different than this because we did a lot of work to get this together. We think and had a lot of people working on it. We think we understand what the movers and users looks like. We may be cool.
These young people will come up with a sampling process that will be statistically absolutely grounded for this purpose. It is something we need to do. We've changed our configuration in recent years, and we were ready to do this, and we don't think it'll change those numbers. One of the things I'd ask you to keep in mind, too, if these numbers change this way a little bit or that way a little bit, it doesn't really change the number of dollars we have in Fund 9.
Right.
But we want to accurately, we have every wish and intention to appropriately and accurately fund each of these stamp programs. Because the people that are buying these stamps understand that stamp has a purpose. And we want to be sure that it is addressed and addressed as accurately as we can.
As Bob said, we have changed our stamp structure such that there will be some significant changes in how the dollars will line up because there's no longer a white wing dove stamp and a green stamp.
But isn't that going to make it easier to have the combined?
It will make it easier, but for example, the migratory gangler stamp is going to be the biggest stamp in the deal because it has all the duck hunters and all the dove hunters as opposed to how the two used to be separated out. So you'll have a single fairly large stamp. So
in other words, if it's gone to the proportional, that would have been the biggest. If you were using it proportionally, you get the new combined.
If you lump white wing, turkey, waterfowl together, there's all these different combinations. So we'll get that squared up.
Maybe I'm missing something, but for example, up there we've got the fishing and the hunting being equal. So I guess our assumption is that if you fish and hunt, is that.
Our assumption is you buy a super combo, you bought it for the purpose of fishing and hunting.
Now, wouldn't the most accurate way of determining that be the actual user? When I come in to renew and buy a combo, to say, although I bought a combo for the last 5 years, I've never used it for this purpose or this other purpose. Is the purpose to define the use? In other words, if I buy a combo, is the whole purpose to determine whether I'm only using two as compared to everything that I bought?
Yes.
And wouldn't the best source be the person that bought it when he bought it? In other words, if I've had it for the last 5 years when I renew it, and I say I've been buying the combo, but I really only fish.
And that would be the absolute best way to do it. However, again, we're asking our 18-year-old Walmart clerk to collect that data. And we're already having enough problems getting data collection at the point of sale. And that's why we're going back to a dedicated survey that's specifically going to go to only super combo buyers and specifically ask them what they do. We may find out something. We may find out because we're going to ask them, did you hunt?
Right.
And did you fish?
So that's
find
really
out
important.
We're going to ask 99% of them fish. So this how this equal allocation between the hunting license and the fishing license may not occur because our survey data may tell us that you bought a super combo but you didn't hunt with it or you didn't fish with it. Right. So you're not going to get attributed the fishing license.
And I think there's a lot of that. A lot of my friends buy it, they say, because we're helping Parks and Wildlife. And I'll never go fishing, but I'll contribute to the cost.
We're going to find that out.
it'll be an interesting piece of information, but remember that other than being dedicated to Fund 9, that money's not dedicated to fishing or dedicated to hunting. You know, it's used in law enforcement, it's used in fishing, sure. It's used in that
15 million in those two categories.
The only point I was trying to make is it seemed to me that at the retail level is where you would get the most accurate reflection of what's happening. But if our retailers are not willing to go through that exercise,
yeah. Our experience there was the fifth question.
The important thing is, taking an example of saltwater scan, where depending on which allocation method you use, it's a huge percentage of the total of that one stamp program, and that one stamp program has a specific job like buyback or a shrimp license. That's where you need to be focused, and not on the fund nine side. That's where the Coastal Resources Advisory Committee says, wait a second, how much money do we have to buy a shrimp license? Is that 50% more than you said, or 50% less?
So if there aren't any other questions, just from the deviation from your agenda a little bit, I would ask for the chairman's permission to publish a definition of net receipts in Texas Register for public comment and come back to you in August with an adoption of that definition. Chairman's purview.
Authorize you to publish it in the Texas Register.
Thank you.
It's been reviewed, that definition with the
Any further questions for Gene?
Thank you. Item number 6, Survey of Organizational Excellence. Allie?
Good morning, Commissioners. For the record, my name is Al Bingham. I'm Human Resources Division Director. Today, I'm going to brief you on the status of our most important resource, our human resources. The Survey of Organizational Excellence is an employee attitude survey, and every couple of years, we survey our employees to get their perceptions of how the organization is doing. What do they perceive the strengths to be, and what do they perceive the areas of concern? A little bit of background about the survey. It began back in 1979 to assess how the average state employee felt about working for the state. Since then, it's evolved into more of a strategic tool used to access organizational strengths and increase employee involvement. The survey is administered by the UC School of Social Work, and to date, over 75 public and private organizations have used the instrument, and over 200,000 instruments have been distributed. The survey is designed to capture information about individual respondents and their immediate workplace, as well as broader issues and concerns, such as compensation, which are applicable to employees organization-wide. For 2006, 54% of ADP employees participated in the survey, and that's a significant improvement over prior years. I want to stress that the higher rates of participation are very important for a couple of reasons. Number one, the higher rates are an indication that employees are engaged with the organization. They have concerns about the organization. They want to be involved with problem solving the organization. From a management perspective, higher rates of participation are good because managers are less inclined to perceive that just disgruntled employees are responding to the survey, and as a consequence are more likely to act on survey results. So that's very important. We'll continue to try to stress and achieve 100% participation in the survey. A good thing about the survey is that it allows to benchmark the information over a period of time, both with ourselves and with other organizations of similar size and mission. The survey was administered a couple of weeks back in January and February of 2006. As I said, our goal was to reach 100% of the employees on the payroll at that time. To that end, over 3,000 surveys were distributed. Employees had the opportunity to take the survey online, and we also distributed paper copies. just over 1,600 employees responded. 26% of the total respondents came from the headquarters, 74% from fields, and this distribution generally follows our staffing distribution fields and headquarters. The participant profiles generally follow our workforce demographics as far as age and gender and ethnicity.
Is that age breakdown consistent? That's consistent with CPW?
Yes, sir. We have a mature workforce.
Yeah, one out of three.
Mature. Why?
No doubt.
Be careful.
Okay,
go ahead.
On a positive note, the vast majority of folks surveyed indicated that they plan to be with the outfit over the next couple of years. That's encouraging. They indicated that they haven't had a lot of promotions and merit increases. I think the fact that we have such a low turnover rate when compared to the state speaks to the fact that for most of our employees, it's more than just about pay. The employees recognize the importance of our mission and they genuinely enjoy the job. This particular survey looks at organizational life across five dimensions, work groups, accommodations, organizational features, information, and personal demands. And each of these dimensions consists of several constructs. The dimension scores range from a low of 100 to a high of 500. Here you see the various dimensions and constructs. For example, dimension one concerns work groups. This dimension relates to the interactions between employees and their coworkers and supervisors and other folks that are closely involved in their day-to-day activities. It includes such constructs as supervisor effectiveness, fairness, team effectiveness, and diversity. The second dimension, accommodations, it gets to the adequacy of the physical environment and the resources that employees have to do their job. It also takes a look at compensation and benefits issues. The third dimension, organizational features, this dimension gets at the corporate culture. The fourth dimension, information, looks at the flow of information, both internal and external information, how it's processed in the organization, the flow of information up and down and across divisions. And that final dimension, personal demand, it looks at the degree in which employees are feeling stressed in the job. The highest scoring constructs represent areas of strength, and the lowest scoring constructs represent areas of concern. And as I said, the constructs range from 100 to 500. According to the survey administrators, any score below 300 indicates strong negativity on the part of the employee. Anything less than 200 requires immediate management attention. Here you see the overall scores for the agency. The higher scoring constructs are in the blue, the scores to the right of the bar graph, and the lower scoring constructs are the darker color. There were significant differences between headquarters employees' perceptions and those of field employees. You see here on this particular graph, headquarters staff generally rated the areas of lower than the agency average, generally across the board. On the other hand, the field employees generally, their scores were a little higher than the agency average. There are also some differences across divisions, and each division was given information about their particular scoring. As I said, one of the good things about the survey, we've been doing it since 1998, it gives us the opportunity to see change over the period of time. The hash marks, the cross marks areas of the graph show the 1998 scoring, and the solid areas of the graph show just the more recent scoring. And in most areas, you can see that there was significant improvement in all areas since 98. The most notable concern, obviously, is in the area of fair pay. That particular area scored lower than 1998. From the employee's perspective, the areas of strength for the organization are strategic orientation, that is how the organization responds to external influences, our adherence to quality principles, how we process external information. Our information flows into the organization from external sources and from inside to external constituents. That area of burnout, that's not a negative. Basically, what that indicates over high score there, and it indicates that our employees are not feeling overdue stress and burnout on the job. The physical environment, generally folks believe they have the equipment and supplies needed to do their job, and they believe that it's safe. The areas of concern, obviously one of the areas is pay. How we process internal information. Supervisor effectiveness. One of the things that Mr. Cook and I regularly do is to monitor the comments that employees make when they exit the organization. And consistently, while a high number of our employees leave due to retirement, a high number note that issues with supervisors as a reason for leaving. I would say that employees join organizations for new supervisors. So that's an area of concern that we'll continue to monitor and work with. Another area is team effectiveness and our change orientation. On a positive note, we've seen adequate improvement in many areas. 17 of 20 constructs showed improvement since the last iteration of the survey. Negative changes, most notably in the area of pay compensation, seem to have worsened since the last survey. Here you see that the change from the last survey. Again, across the board, generally, we've seen improvement in most areas. Focus issues. It's easy for us to say we're going to spend most of our time addressing areas of concern, but it's equally important for us not to let the things that employees perceive that we do well slip. For example, if you notice up in the top of the chart there in the area of strategic orientation, while it's still an area of strength for us, it's a 3-point drop since 1998. So we continue to work on the areas of concern, as well as ensure that we continue to do the things well, do the things that we do well. Where do we go from here? Well, we rolled out this data. We had an initial briefing with Mr. Cook and the other executives back in April. We've asked that each division appoint a division representative to be a part of our change team. Our plan is for HR staff to train the division liaisons to conduct focus groups within their respective divisions, and then we'll come together and kind of delve into some of the issues that employees are identified, seek recommendations from those employees, and then present them to Mr. Cook with the idea that we would actively seek to make some positive changes. We would hope to implement any corrective actions over the next 6 months with the idea that we would resurvey employees on specific areas to document the effectiveness of any things noted sometime next spring. And with that, available for questions. Yes, sir.
I mentioned that you had a breakout between field and HQ on Sunday. One that particularly interests me is the, how do you say, the internal information, the flow of communication within the organization. Is that area of concern better or worse in the field than HQ?
It seems to...
The reason I ask is that, you know, I often hear from the constituents and both people in the field that not the best coordination sometimes, whether it's permitting or regulatory issue.
It seems to be the same in particular areas of both.
It's pretty much the same for both?
Yes.
Then do you also test between the two, between HQ, or am I asking it wrong? Is that measuring within the field staff? Communication within field staff, communication between HQ and field staff.
You know, basically what it's getting at is communication within a particular work unit division,
mm-hmm.
and as well as information that's needed to be transported across division lines. That's what it's getting to. Are employees receiving the information that they need to effectively do their job?
Yeah, you know, this ejection, you know, it's a good question because, you know, I've heard that and still do. It's something you have to really focus on.
But it's no more difficult these days, I think, to get the message, the correct message to the field and understood than it is to get the correct message to the guy in the office next door and understood. And, you know, we work on that all the time. I guess I just say that. Within the divisions, within a district work group, you know, it takes a good communicator, somebody who's listening, and, you know, effective information has to come down. Effective information has to be distributed.
I'm more concerned about the classic story. Everybody's got their hand in the, you know, classic story. As I was out one time with a group of biologists and ran into another group of biologists in the building division and like, what are you doing? And they were essentially doing the same work. And the landowner was sitting there going, what's going on?
No, I guess that.
Sometimes that's what? That's between divisions, that's in the field. Between divisions at HQ, and then the line's got to go.
Exactly.
In a division.
It takes, you can't, I don't believe you can ever reach that point where you're there.
I've got about 3,000 people to attend this question.
Just as a note, Al, in 98, you had four areas of concern that were scored under 300. And the latest one, you had one area of concern under 300. So it just empirically, it looked like you had some pretty significant improvement. And the one that is the most obvious is the most obvious to all of us, and that's fair pay.
Yeah. Goes back to the thing I was talking about a while ago about the classification of our state parking programs that we need to adjust. And, you know, the same thing some of our specialty areas where you've got computer jocks and geeks here that are great, do us a super job.
What are you calling them?
Well, it's kind of like those statisticians. They really wanted me on their team, but Gene wouldn't let me be on their team.
But yeah, you know, I'll get into this side. There's one other issue. I see strategic is the one that's down since 98. I can't help but notice we've had at least two strategic plans since 98. Is that a communication problem, or is that, what is that problem?
I said we've been working with quote unquote two plans, the strategic plan through the LAR and then the land and water plan. I think more and more, if we, you know, tie everything to the land and water plan, that improves. I think basically just the lack of understanding which plan we're involved.
Right.
If anybody who answers questions here, because it's less than a 1% vote.
Yeah.
You've got a 54% response to the survey.
Mm-hmm.
It's a pretty small number. Whereas that other one is 77.2. Any other questions for Al? Thanks very much, Al. Thank you. Mr. Cook?
I believe that's it.